So this is side two of session 38, recorded on April 30th, 2007. Now, Scott, you were saying something about the terms.
Yeah, something that anybody who knows you probably already knows this, but just for the, because we're in the Croker quadrant, we're still kind of making distinctions between the radio body or landscape and the TV landscape and so on. And then by the time we get to the bodies and we talk about the radio body, the chip body, well, we don't talk about the radio, but the TV body or the chip body, really it's all, we're just doing that to talk about it, but it's really one thing. There's only one body.
Yeah.
And it's the merged TV, chip, astral, and chemical body.
Right, and the effect of that, of those four bodies, is the place that we think we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So the anthropomorphic physical human projection of it's something separate from something else, or it's inside an environment. The environment we're in is the effect of the merger of those four bodies. And so the chart is a pictorial presentation of the constituents of that merged state. And those constituents don't really exist, but they come out of and prop up the sense of the AP anthropomorphic physical. But where is it? It does not have any chemical body social standards, as Croker says, external standards of public conduct. It has some that come through the TV meme, Fox TV, say. It has standards of communication when you're doing email.
Yeah, or you could turn on, you know, Judge Judy or Court TV, and you still get this sense that there are laws and rules, and you will go to jail if you break them.
Right, and you get a sense of their reality by looking at a dramatization of the historical institution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an image of it. So what image are we? What are we made up of when these four old landscapes have merged and become puny and tiny and become one meme? I say it is the Android meme talking to itself, and then an after image of that talking to nobody. And so the perfect mirror of that is the era of President George Bush II. So he's a non-communicating nincompoop. That is the closest image of where we're at, because we have no way to define this.
Mm-hmm.
So the prevalent mood is chaos and panic, paranoia, hysteria, schizophrenia, and ecstasy, all jumbled in there on the social landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And in Nicole Smith, there's someone who projected an image of ecstasy, right? Just mindless consumption.
Yeah.
Suicide bombers, they're projecting paranoia or hysteria. So you get all kinds of stereotypes clashing across the sense of the landscape that the human body is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to the beginning of this section, the Panic Encyclopedia.
Now, let me just say this. What I just said about paranoia and hysteria, remember he says, between ecstasy and fear, between delirium and anxiety. That's a good description of life in this decade.
Mm-hmm.
It's four parts, quadraphenic, and hard to say which one you're stabilized in. Okay, what were we going to say?
To the beginning of this section, he says ecstasy of catastrophe and anxiety of fear. Now, McLuhan said we lived in an age of anxiety.
Yeah, well, I think the phrase, the concept of dread, was the name of a book by Kierkegaard, 1844, when the telegraph was just beginning to become an environment. And I think the themes of anxiety stem from Kierkegaard's philosophy and then gets into existentialism.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a precursor to the existentialists. So it's been around a long time, the phrase age of anxiety. McLuhan would explain where it came from. He said basically the clash between electronic technologies and the older print industrial technologies led to a schizophrenia and anxiety for 20th century humans.
Mm-hmm.
So he was pointing out the causes of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that he invented the notion that we were in the age of anxiety.
Right. Well, anxiety's always been part of human.
Right. It's the public space, the social space. The industrial space is what acquired a mood of anxiety.
Then reading down here, and he says the dissolution of facts into the flash of thermonuclear cultural events.
Yeah, like the Kennedy assassination or any major news event is like a bomb across the planet.
Mm.
It's a cultural bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an event. But Baudrillard goes into how these events really don't have any substance because the immediate coverage by all the other older media of the apparent event dissipates, dissolves any certainty about what happened or what's the meaning or result of it.
Mm-hmm.
So Coker thinks that one of the first postmodern events was the Kennedy assassination. Therefore, it never got resolved.
Mm.
Yet it spawns an industry of entertainment forms around it. Books and movies.
Right.
And research groups. All trying to find out the facts.
Yeah.
But they've disappeared.
Who was involved in the Watergate break-in? Was that Ehrlichman or Haldeman?
No, T. Gordon Liddy.
And who
he's the icon that came out of that.
Yeah, and who's the other guy?
Howard Hunt. E. Howard Hunt.
There was somebody else. Wasn't Ehrlichman or Haldeman? It wasn't either of those guys.
Well, they were part of the semi-in-the-know about Nixon giving the orders to the plumbers. And the plumbers were Gordon and E. Howard Hunt.
Hmm. Hmm.
So they were part of the management cover-up, and Watergate burglars were the workers.
Right.
The event creators.
Okay.
So why? Why'd you bring up
well,
that?
Well, the reason why... Well, I should check my facts first before I bring this up, but I heard this guy on the radio the other day who's the son of one of those four people, but it wasn't, I think it was either Ehrlichman or Haldeman. That's why I keep bringing up those, trying to remember those names. It wasn't Gordon Liddy.
Well, they went to jail. They were part of Watergate. I think they went to jail.
Yeah. Well, one of those guys had a kid who he actually involved in, he came home from the break-in at the Watergate, and he had all this photographic and spy equipment in the back of his car that he needed to dispose of. So he woke his kid up and he said, "Look, you got to help me. Don't ask me any questions. Just help me out." So they pull all the equipment out of the car, and the kid's helping them wipe it down for fingerprints, and they drive and they dump it in a river someplace, and so now he's an unwitting co-conspirator in this whole thing. And it was kind of his dad's way of bonding with his son, because they were leading kind of separate lives, and now all of a sudden the kid's kind of part of his dad's life, and his dad confessed on tape recorder to actually what happened in the Kennedy assassination, who the second shooter was and who arranged the whole thing. And the guy's got it on audio tape, and he's about to go public with it. So we may actually find out what happened in the Kennedy assassination.
Is this someone who was on Art Bell?
Yeah, but on when they have the alternate host on, Ian Punnett, yeah.
Yeah, so this kid could be making it up. Makes a good story.
No, he's not making it up. You know, he went into depth about his relationship with his dad, and he's got the tape of his dad confessed. His dad confessed, gave him the tape, and said, you know, don't release this until after I'm dead. He says, I got to get this off my chest, but you know, I don't want this to get leaked out before I'm dead. So he's got the tape, and you know, if it comes out, then it's for real.
But you're forgetting that we're in a simulated environment most anything can be. Look at the Elvis tapes. Things can be imitated and acted out now and edited and modulated.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting that most of the time now, nothing can be verifiable.
Yeah.
Look at the technology that we
have.
Well,
you listen to this guy and you hear the sincerity in his voice, it's pretty hard to believe that he would make up a whole fantasy about his relationship with his dad. You know?
No, he might have had a relationship, but there may be people around him that have influenced him in some way.
Yeah, well, that's possible. I guess you can't ever be too sure about anything.
Well, I know what happened to Kennedy's assassination, so we'll be able to decide whether it's real or not what he says.
Yeah.
So when's he going to release it?
Well, Ian asked him if he would air the tape on his show, and the guy said, "Yeah." He said he needed to get a few things in order, and that they would do that. So it may be coming up in the near future.
Right. So why is he talking about it now?
He wrote a book, I guess.
Oh, he's got a book out.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can find out who it is just by going on the Art Bell site and seeing who was interviewed a couple of days ago?
Yeah.
Well, Ian's usually on Saturday night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you want to do about... let's take this son. He is the first human being to live in the dead zone of the fatal attraction between postmodern science and popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
Take any of these quotes and apply it to his attempt to get in the media.
Okay, yeah, here we go. Ian welcomes, his name is St. John Hunt, the eldest son of the super spy, E. Howard Hunt,
right,
for discussion about how his father had direct knowledge of the planning of the JFK assassination.
Yeah, now Hunt, he's an interesting disinformation guy. I'd be interested in what, I think we've already heard from him. I think he said recently LBJ did it or something.
That's what he implied. Now, he's dead now, so he didn't, I don't know how recently it was that he could have said that, but that's what he said, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not what happened.
Oh, okay.
LBJ did not initiate the assassination.
Mm.
He didn't even know who did it,
mm,
who organized it. So that is disinformation coming from his father.
Wow.
So the kid wouldn't know that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of weird that a father would use his son as a dupe, but...
Well, the E. Howard Hunt is protecting the institutions he was part of.
Yeah.
Like the FBI. So he's going to direct it away, and so it's like it's a little present to his inner team that he always worked with in the FBI.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or the CIA, whatever institution he was, it could, a guy like that could overlap.
Right.
The thing is, he distracts it into... So it's his last gift to his institutions as well. I'm supposed to be an insider. Well, I'll direct them over there, and they won't know we over there did it.
Right.
He did it, but... And he may have figured that out and thought it led there because they only knew a certain amount of it.
Right. Yeah, because I think for the public record, after he was busted, he never went back into intelligence for the public record, but he told his son that actually he did go back into intelligence and was working in intelligence, I think, until, you know, near he died.
Yeah, he's working for a faction. The real serious information about JFK came out in 1990 when that kid, I can't remember his name now, down in Texas, he claimed his father was a shooter on the grassy knoll. And if you notice, Admiral Bobby Inman went directly to the place where this kid was around Texas, Austin, Texas, or someplace, and put out the story that the kid was insane. And Bobby Inman immediately went into action and put out a disinformation campaign because the son was semi-accurate. His father was involved, but not on the on the grassy knoll, but related to that. And so they had to seriously discredit this kid, and they did. They're not doing it to Howard Hunt's son.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really go after you, seriously do a hit job on you and an information pattern about you, you know, basically a smear job, then you haven't touched anything.
Hmm.
So he was probably one of the last ones, one of the rare ones to come out with something that was real.
Yeah.
He was on CNN, Larry King, and all that.
Who was?
This kid.
Oh, the kid. Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know he'd been already in the media.
Oh, no, I'm talking about back in 1990.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
The son of somebody related to the sniper.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
He had found his diaries and that. The guy His father died in a fire in 1971. Mm. Why did that happen?
Yeah. Well, E. Howard Hunt's wife died in a plane crash. How'd that happen?
Oh, that's because she was taking $1 million to pay off certain people on behalf of Nixon. It was in the middle of Watergate. That was a serious operation.
Yeah.
Serious, necessary murder.
Yeah.
For some people to protect themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, this kid said that his dad, E. Howard Hunt, actually blackmailed Nixon. He had the goods on him, and he felt like he and his team were getting screwed over. And he said, "If you don't, you know, give us our due, we're going to go public with this information."
So he presented as if money was being paid to him as an enemy of Nixon.
Yeah.
Don't know if that was the actual. Oh, I do know what the actual situation is, but I don't think it was that. I can't say. I'm not going to say what it is. It was important that she go to Chicago and pay off certain people.
Yeah.
On behalf of Nixon.
Yeah.
So a guy like E. Howard Hunt's going to put in a lot of the mirror images of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know why he would care. I mean, after he's dead, why would he care? Why wouldn't he want to tell the truth? You know, where they say people on their deathbed, they don't have anything to lose.
Yeah, but truth is like a humanist, industrial, literate artifact. Once you get into a post-literate or pre-literate society, you get into tribal loyalties. And he's expressing information and patterns that are loyal to the people that he worked with. And that's where his sense of meaning comes from, his personal loyalty to his team. And he puts out information for the historical record to help that team to remain invisible or covered up or protected in its own institutional prestige.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we look at Croker's post-fact situation. We can go over to the Croker, to LaRouche zone, and LaRouche says the same thing in his context. He explains the rampaging of lies and of disinformation and misinformation as a product of managers representing nefarious historical entities. So LaRouche would agree that they were in a post-fact situation, that he would present his information as the real facts or the historical facts. He wouldn't go as far as Croker saying that nobody can present any facts in this situation.
Yeah, that's a pretty extreme statement. Croker's saying he doesn't trust anybody to know what the facts are.
Well, this is Baudrillard. When he's coming out of Baudrillard, and as McLuhan said, television was pure fantasy. TV news is pure fantasy.
Yeah.
So,
on Croker's album Spasm, I noticed this place where he has George Bush Sr.'s voice in a tape loop saying, "I don't care what the facts are. I don't care what the facts are."
That's right. It's like McLuhan had this statement he used to quote. I don't know who said it. "I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt."
Yeah.
Now, what's that mean? That means you're loyal to some other post-literate, post-informational bit of information. You're loyal to an environment, and the environment is a team of people that work with some artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sure about them, about how that works. And literate bits of information in a world where the information overload cancels everything out, the event is thermonuclear, doesn't matter what the facts are. What it is, what does matter is your mixed media team in relation to other teams and what your ratio is to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I call mythic stage warfare. And myth, as defined by me, is a combination of any media. So you're made up of certain media. And that doesn't mean news media, it means historical artifacts. And your mixture makes up your particular bias.
And well, so if you're a public figure, your image is broadcast in different media, and that creates public perception. But for the average guy who's not in the media, I don't know if that applies.
No, that's right. You're just thinking of media as news. You don't have to be known about to engage in media. A car is media.
Yeah.
Rush Limbaugh represents the consumerist paradise of basically hardware technology of the 50s and 60s. That's what he's a reminder of. Those media.
Yeah.
Cars and golf and suburbia and small towns and hardworking people. All sort of basically high modern or advanced industrial phase of life.
Mm-hmm.
And his ideological enemies are all those post-industrial software, quote, media elites and liberal elites that are in Hollywood or in New York City and are creative movements like gays and feminists, you know, all postmodern movements. That's what he's up against. So he represents the TV meme in relation to the fragmentation and decentralizing of the TV meme.
Mm-hmm. The red states.
Yeah. Now, he rides with that meme through a complex chip body landscape. He's got a very advanced website. They feature, you know, media sound bites, news clips, constant coverage of himself and replays and transcripts of his radio shows, just an ongoing media empire. So he's using this new quadrophenic environment to prop up a specialist meme. Specialist image.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just one. You know, you can go into any of the others. Howard Stern. Now, they both operate on a level of cynicism. They don't believe the major media. They delight in making fun of the old TV landscape consensus creators.
Yeah. But if the White House is the old TV consensus creator, they've created a consensus that, like Howard Stern, and can't even, you know, he's got to go off into satellite land because he can't even play in the consensus media anymore.
Yes, but he makes millions of dollars being the image of someone spurned by the old media,
mm-hmm.
by the old consensus media.
Mm-hmm.
That's his charisma.
Mm-hmm.
He's orbiting around it. He's got a big audience.
Mm.
Had a big audience.
Yeah.
So his image is more of the decentralization. His themes are usually the effect of the decentralization of the 50s and 60s culture, but he's actually talking about the chip effects, or lives in the chip effects, but he talks about it in terms of called the 70s and 80s media imagery that stuck its finger in the face of the consensus analog media of the 50s and 60s, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's his image. And that he doesn't need to be in the old culture. He just has to have the old culture be there that he can dance on his toes.
Mm-hmm. So then in contemporary physics, did they discover 90% of the natural universe is missing matter?
Well, remember the phrase dark energy or dark matter?
Yeah.
Which is very popular now. Well, that's been around for a long time.
But that means they found what they thought was missing. Now they,
yeah,
but they,
yeah.
But they call it dark.
Yeah, yeah. But it's been a commonplace in physics, in quantum physics, that, you know, the spaces between particles is potent and huge.
Mm.
Missing particles, missing waves, maybe.
Mm.
But that's just highlighting the gap, the resonant interval.
Zero point energy?
Yeah, well, zero point is zero point, the phrase, means the gap. All of this new, very advanced technology works with the gap, what we call tactility,
mm-hmm.
extension of tactility. And TV was the beginning of tactility. The revolution caused by television was that we had a tactile medium.
Mm-hmm.
Then the chip technology fine-tunes it.
Yeah. TV actually goes from its phases from being cool to hot, I guess. You know, I mean, originally you had the black and white staticky image so you could barely make out what was going on. That was pretty cool. Now you got high-definition TV in relation to other media, which...
Yes, T TV had to become its opposite.
What's a cool medium today?
Maybe the interactivity of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you are a maker and pretending to look for matching, but you're interplaying matching and making.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the under satellite conditions. There was the tactility of television became larger because from the satellite's perspective, the interplay of TV, radio, bulldozers, skyscrapers, oil tankers, newspapers, all the media, from the satellite's perspective, it was looking at the interplay of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the medium for extending and managing that interplay is the digital technology. So the digital creates not just a tactile television, which itself is a tactile medium, but the interplay of all historical media and new media is the new resonant interval, right?
Mm-hmm.
The interval between these environments. And as that's got tinier and tinier holopathically, you get to what we call zero point, which is a phrase referring to endless energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the Android meme has reached a zero point, a resonant interval, transparent membrane, interplaying and being all the media, because they've all imploded to become it, and that is there 24/7, and that's like perpetual motion, more energy coming out than put in. So it's a prefiguring of the actual hardware zero-point energy cold fusion, which will bring in frictionless energy technologically, hardware-wise, for power sources. Not image power, but body power,
yeah.
Heat. It's like merging with first nature and starts to create environments that aren't controlled by the sun,
mm-hmm.
because it's desktop sun.
Right.
So the interval between environments has become tinier and tinier. But since tactility in the resonant node cannot be measured, it's always the same tactility. It's just becoming more and more a figure of things. Tactility as an interplay of environments has become the zero-point figure of itself.
Well, if tactility became figure, I think everybody would be blinded by the light, as it were.
That might have happened in the 60s with the interplay of the media under the satellite umbrella. Therefore, the psychedelic culture's romanticizing of the Tibetan Book of the Dead's, clear white light.
Mm-hmm.
The blinding light. McLuhan defines tactility as, it's not a color, the color that reflects tactility is the color for its afterimage, and that's black. So dark matter, its essential cliche emptiness or darkness, is the visualization of the unvisualizable tactile.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't visualize.
Yeah, that's why it's hard to talk about.
Beg your pardon?
That's why it's hard to talk about.
Yeah, you can't see it or
use imagery to, think about things.
Beg your pardon?
We use imagery to think about things.
Yeah, you can't image it, you can't say it, you can't dance it, you can't use any normal chemical body medium sense to express it, because it's the interplay. So what happens, all the old inadequate sensory forms of communication go into hyper overdrive. So in the 60s you have electrified loud music. That's acoustic space attempting to communicate tactility, but it's going to be incomplete, so it just starts screaming. Now you can look at that.
Now how's it different? I mean, we got this one beautiful, Bach and Beethoven and so on as compensation for the fact that the eye had been amputated by the book.
Right.
So, but the eye is. The book has disappeared by the time rock and roll comes in. So what's rock and roll compensation for? No longer compensating for the amputation of the eye.
No, it's compensating for the amputation of tactility or the extension of tactility.
Mm-hmm.
Since we've entered the void, now you look at the popular fads and intellectual trends of the 50s and 60s. A lot of it was the popularity of Zen. And Zen talks about the void. And the void was a concept for the physical fact of tactility being a non-visualizable, non-listenable interplay of senses. Okay? So the point is, when you have the extension of all the sense, the interplay of the senses, the compensation is not just ear music a la classical Beethoven in response to the eye numbness. You now have tactility numbness, so the response to that is a hypermassage of all five senses.
Mm-hmm.
You have speeding cars. You have horse races. You have many hyped-up cinema, hyped-up television, hyped-up music, amplified. That has been the characteristics of pop culture for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it flipped into verbal rapping.
Right. After
hip-hop.
What probably the speed up hit its extreme with the punk guys. I mean, they were just going as fast as they could go, just because
they were trying to approximate the naive view that tactility was kinetic.
Yeah.
So you make it as fast as possible, but that's not tactility, because tactility isn't anything. It's the interplay. And so we're in the post-tactile culture. It's another aspect of the post-information society, since the electric society has been an information society, and that's been content within a tactile medium. We're now post-tactile. So post-tactile, post-screaming and yelling, was prefigured by hip-hop, where guys came in and simulated verbal aggression, like caveman, what I call neo-paleolithic.
Mm-hmm.
And then that gradually entered politics. So now you have the Age of Terror. Bush being this punk rapper who doesn't even bother to make rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
So rap is the last attempt to communicate the post-tactile environment. When you get past that, then you're into paranoia and the Age of Terror and suicide bombers as the pop stars of our time,
mm-hmm.
or the pop metaphor.
Did you ever notice how Bush likes to puff up his chest and walk like he's communicating through gesture?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, primitive caveman posturing.
Yeah.
And so if we don't have any social media to buffer our interactions, then it's pretty aggressive, psychopathic, and pre-human. Now, is the caveman, you could say that the beginning of the unconscious and then memory and culture, that's when we became human. Bush is being human, but it's like just the early stages of being human. You still got a lot of the ape-like posturing, you know, the naked ape
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff, which was a book, came out around 68. So we actually, now under cold fusion technology, I say we merge first nature and second nature. But we already have that simulated in the Android meme. So it's simulating first nature and second nature. If we think of our technologies and clothing as second nature, and that's being stripped away, then the merger of first and second nature that the Android meme imitates, prefigures that cold fusion will bring in, you would have a political stage favoring uncivilized, uncultured, unhumanized first nature instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the landscape we witness now in this decade.
Yeah.
This raw expression of cultural identity in a very crude, impolite way.
Yeah.
A strutting.
Yeah, yeah.
Animal strutting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then also the nihilism of the cynical and nihilistic approach to expressing yourself through the violence that's focused on in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So Iraq is the San Francisco of this decade. It's the image of what people feel like doing and what they feel like they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the fact that it might be happening because some oil companies want to want to exploit the Middle East, that's their efficient causality agenda, but they're inside a Android meme, a post-Android meme media vortex that brings it up as a figure for other reasons. Because you can look at what's going on in Iraq as exactly what goes on in our society every day with YouTube. You have millions of people making bombs on YouTube, information bombs, sending it out, nuking people. I don't think they see it that way, but the freedom and anarchy and chaos that they can create and express in relation to old previous standards of consensus or morality or meaning, it's a form of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Us making these tapes and posting on Five Bodies is an act of terrorism. Information warfare.
Yeah, in a post-information environment where I don't know if it has any significance in a post-information environment.
Right, and if you're not aware of that, you might just intuit there's no significance and get more desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Good example of this was Anna Nicole Smith, right?
Yeah. Well.
Or just looking on the American Idol situation. There's no standards of skill. It's just who can create a sensational impact through some replay of some kind of singing,
mm-hmm.
entertainment gig, karaoke, and project it out there and see who waves at the flag.
Mm-hmm.
It goes nowhere.
Yeah. Let's see, a little while ago you mentioned how Africa jumped into the digital world without having gone through industrialization. Now China is going through industrialization under chip conditions. Now, that should be interesting to see how that works out.
Well, they get so many people, they can have one quarter of their population not starving. And they can say, we got 300 million middle-class, comfortable people.
Mm-hmm.
As much as you have in the United States, and you don't have that many people comfortable in the United States. We got more people comfortable than you, but it's only one quarter of their population. The rest of the people are starving.
Yeah.
So they have a big raw resource that they can manipulate image-wise.
Mm-hmm. The United States was founded on the printing press. I don't know if we can say China was founded on the chip body, but they are industrializing under the chip body.
The Chinese were founded on history. They being the oldest civilization on the planet, maybe?
Yeah.
So they have that pride in their history.
Yeah.
And we're all newcomers to them.
Right.
Now but that's anthropomorphic chemical body culture. Well, I shouldn't say just that's anthropomorphic. All media are anthropomorphic, but that's chemical body culture. They can claim the oldest. But they got to deal with the chip body and the chip landscape, the TV landscape, which they're gradually being forced to adopt. And that's a threat to their chemical body cultural standards.
Mm-hmm.
So they remain very totalitarian in policing the citizens' chemical body activities while creating a little bacteria petri dish that is not Chinese, it is something postmodern. It's TV and chip body cyborgs,
mm-hmm.
300 million of them, interacting with the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
So China has to prop up them and say, look, we're developing an advanced modern culture, but it ain't Chinese. It's a grafting on of what happened in North America and Europe in the 50s and 60s. And then you got the chip effect, which is reflected in Wall Street and the global economy, because remember China on February 26th, 27th this year went down a little bit, caused a panic, right, on the markets.
Right.
So China,
and then just in this last week, the markets hit a new all-time high.
Yeah, and they did it in like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
It took like 5 years to go to 12,000, from 12,000 to 13,000, 13,000, no, 11 to 12. thousand, but from 12 to 13 took 4 or 5 months. So that's a speed and rapidity that doesn't relate to any chemical body standards. As a matter of fact, it's still jittery, even though it couldn't celebrate this arrival because there's so many other indications of older environments that are in trouble, like the subprime mortgages starting to affect the prime mortgages, unemployment, war fears, bankruptcy. So you can't say with a blanket GDP statement of where the culture is because there's so many environments and historical baggage that needs to be accounted for. And in the regular news, there's not time to do that.
Yeah.
So you come up with Frank Zingroni's phrase, media simplex, the complexity of our times, interplaying the tactile environments and the post-tactile, and all the historical cultures. That's a complexity, but it has to be sort of harmonized through a veneer of musical news or Good Morning America kind of shows or Oprah shows or American Idol shows, which are very simple in terms of the wishes and desires and what's communicated in relation to the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a media... It's not an entertainment military-industrial complex, or even an entertainment medical-industrial-military complex. It's a media simplex.
Mm-hmm.
Not a complex, it's a simplex.
Yeah. And it's, I guess, it kind of seems like it's alive in a way. I mean, it's kind of running itself, isn't it, in some weird way?
Well, is language alive? Does language run itself? You ever notice how hard it is for people to stop talking?
Yeah.
All right. So what is language? Is it a machine run amok? Then these later media are just extensions of that. So there was a...
But they're no longer talking amongst themselves. Wouldn't you say that, don't you?
Who's they?
The act... You know, you used to talk about the media as being the actors on the stage in the global theater.
Yeah.
Talking amongst themselves.
Right.
But we're kind of post that now, right?
Yeah, there's no talk going on.
Well, the talk's still going on, but...
That's the fact that memes don't disappear. So those are old environments still going on. But the constituent present that molds them at this point is like the container, in quotes, for the whole situation, is the White House that ain't communicating.
And that's what you mean by post-tactile?
Yeah. Tactile being still a communication interaction.
Yeah. I mean, tactility is at an all-time high, just like the stock market.
Right.
But then
it's obsolete.
Yeah, but then there's a deeper constituent in which it's just...
yeah, that's why they're not celebrating the 13,000, because they're up against the post-information White House image.
Uh-huh.
Vice President Cheney.
Nothing.
Attorney General, what is he, Attorney General Gonzalez or Solicitor General, whatever he is.
Yeah.
They have nothing but scandals. That's what motivates the old media that try to have a point of view. Endless scandals.
Yeah.
The scandal is, basically in the Bush administration, is that they don't care. They're unilateral. They're not responding to anybody.
Right.
People who look... conventionally in a newspaper kind of way at their administration say, that's incredible how many scandals have been coming down since Bush got in.
Well, there's more and more and more evidence pointing to what everyone knows, which is that we went into Iraq on false pretenses. But there's never enough critical mass to actually impeach anybody.
Right. Well, that's because you can't get to the... You're using information gathering of evidence to show it went that way. When the reason we're in Iraq is not based on any information. Excuse me. It's not based on a transaction of message to population. It is the panic of the Android meme itself and its constituents expressed in a post-information Neo-Paleolithic ground. It's too many facts. factors involved to measure what it is,
mm-hmm.
what caused it and what it is. And that's why you can't get enough evidence to knock out the non-communicating, unilateral, dominant post-Android mean image known as the President of the United States, because everybody is too involved in the exchange of information, since it's obsolete and works, to be able to deal with the ground. And the ground is a deathly silence. A dark energy, dark matter. So physicists are just conceptualizing what is happening, you could say, technologically / culturally / anthropomorphically.
Well, McLuhan used to say the media are analogical mirrors. But if we look at the ground of where there's nothing's being said, it's like looking in the mirror and there's no reflection.
Right. There's no... Remember, analogical mirrors meant there was the visual mirror, there was a tactile mirror. Television is a tactile mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Radio is the acoustic mirror. Movies is a kinetic mirror. But when all the mirrors crack and you move past the mirrors, there's not even a mirror to look in. And so that's the other problem. That's why Bush can't communicate. He has no one to talk to. So he's very apathetic about even making an attempt to pretend to have someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have no mirrors, which are media and information systems, you're in a state of...
But he still has to get in front of the podium and gesture, and words have to come out of his
mouth. Those are the old mirrors.
He has to create the appearance that there's still a president and there's still a White House.
Right. No media, go away. Still got probably books, more people reading books than ever did in the history of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But those are old media that are still there. But the...